Everyone had to change lifelong habits. At Berkeley, Oppenheimer had refused to schedule a class before 11 a.m. so he could socialize late into the evening. At Los Alamos, he was invariably on his way to the technical area by 7:30 a.m. The tech area, known simply as the T, was surrounded by a 9.5-foot-high woven wire fence topped by two strands of barbed wire. Military police guarding the gate inspected everyone's colored badges. A white badge designated a physicist or other scientist who had the right to roam freely throughout the T. On occasion, Oppenheimer absentmindedly forgot about the all-too-visible armed guards stationed everywhere. One day, he drove up to Los Alamos' main gate and, without even slowing down, whizzed through. The astonished MP shouted a warning and then fired a shot at the car's tires. Oppenheimer stopped, backed up the car, and, after murmuring an apology, drove off. Understandably worried about Oppenheimer's safety, Groves wrote to him in July 1943 requesting that he refrain from driving an automobile for more than a few miles and, for good measure, refrain from flying in airplanes. Like everyone else, Oppenheimer worked 6 days a week, taking off Sunday. But even on workdays, he usually wore casual clothes, reverting to his New Mexico wardrobe of jeans or khaki pants with a blue tie-less work shirt. His colleagues followed suit. "I don't recall seeing a shined pair of shoes during working hours," wrote Bernice Brody. As Oppie walked to the T, his colleagues often fell in behind him and listened quietly as he softly murmured his thoughts of the morning. "There goes the mother hen and all the little chickens," observed one Los Alamos resident. "His pork pie hat, his pipe, and something about his eyes gave him a certain aura," recalled a 23-year-old whack who worked the telephone switchboard. "He never needed to show off or shout. He could have demanded priority one with his telephone calls, but never did. He never really needed to be as kind as he was." The directors studied informality endeared him to many who might otherwise have felt intimidated in his presence. Ed Doty, a young technician with the Army Special Engineer Detachment, SED, wrote his parents after the war about how,
"Several times Dr. Oppenheimer has called for something or other, and every time when I would answer the phone with, 'Doty,' the voice at the other end would say, 'This is Oppie.'"
His informality contrasted sharply with the manner of General Groves, who demanded attention, demanded respect. Oppie, on the other hand, got attention and respect naturally. From the beginning, Oppenheimer and Groves had agreed that everyone's salaries were to be pegged according to each recruit's previous job. This resulted in wide disparities, since a relatively young man recruited from private industry might well be paid much more than an older, tenured professor. To compensate for this inequality, Oppenheimer decreed that rents would be prorated according to salary. When the young physicist Harold Agnew challenged Oppenheimer to explain why a plumber could earn nearly three times the pay of a college graduate, Oppie replied that the plumbers had no idea of the laboratory's importance to the war effort, whereas the scientists did. And that, explained Oppenheimer, justified the pay difference. The scientists, at least, were not working for the money. Oppenheimer himself had been 6 months in Los Alamos when his secretary reminded him one day that he had not yet received a salary check. Everyone put in long hours. The laboratory was open day and night, and Oppenheimer encouraged people to set their own schedules. He refused to allow time clocks to be installed, and a siren was introduced only in October 1944, when one of General Groves' efficiency experts complained about the laxness in regular work hours. "The work was terribly demanding," Beta recalled. The leader of the theoretical division thought that, as science, his work was much less difficult than many things I have done at other times. But the deadlines were highly stressful. "I had the feeling, and this came in my dreams," Beta said, "that I was behind a terribly heavy cart which I had to push up a hill." Scientists accustomed to working with limited resources and virtually no deadlines now had to adjust to a world of unlimited resources and exacting deadlines. Beta worked in Oppenheimer's headquarters, the T building, T for theoretical, a drab, two-story green structure that quickly became the spiritual center of the hill. Nearby sat Dick Feynman, who was as gregarious as Beta was serious. "For me," Beta recalled, "Feynman sort of materialized from Princeton. I hadn't known about him, but Oppenheimer had. He was very lively from the beginning, but he didn't start insulting me until about 2 months after he came." The 37-year-old Bethe liked to have someone around who was willing to argue with him, and the 25-year-old Feynman loved to argue. When the two of them were together, everyone in the building could hear Feynman yelling, "No, no, you're crazy!" or "That's nuts!" Bethe would then quietly explain why he was right. Feynman would calm down for a few minutes and then erupt again with, "That's impossible! You're mad!" Their colleagues soon nicknamed Feynman the Mosquito and Bethe the Battleship.